Welcome to the Appen Appen Podcast, the podcast for people working in real world IT. If you're a sysappen working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy. And it's just the two of us this week, isn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, Jerry's been moving house. So we kind of suspect he's moved in and his internet isn't fully up and running at the moment. So so hopefully we'll see him back next time. Otherwise, we were trying to record one last night as well, weren't we? But not that it matters to everyone listening now, but... we've had issues with quality and we've had issues with different mics and stuff like that in the past, but your issue is quite severe, as in the mic itself wasn't there. So if anyone's tried to do a podcast without a microphone, you probably think that was quite a challenge to do, but it managed to come through today, didn't you? So yep. we're back on track again.
Right. That's good. So is it episode 26 now? So
26. I didn't say that, did I? But 26. Yeah.
Interesting. I wanted to say that I've actually seen a DDoS attack in real life, which is interesting. Which is basically a denial of distributed DNS service. Basically, what that means is that hackers basically send requests, lots and lots of requests, to a website to take it down, to like make it unresponsive. Not unresponsible. So we basically, they had a, there's a thing come out that's like it, where DDoS works is that basically uses UDP packets, and with UDP packets there's no kind of like acknowledgement and saying, sending back data and saying who are you kind of thing before the packet is transmitted, whereas UDP is used for like DNS and traffic where it doesn't really matter if not all the traffic gets there. It's not like TCP where it basically asks when you step a secure channel, well not a secure channel, but a channel, a communication channel between two sites, between a web server and a client that's using HTTP, which is done on TCP, you do kind of acknowledgement things so that traffic packets, so if a packet gets dropped, the client can say, hang on, I didn't get that packet, can you send it again? Whereas UDP, the client asks for the traffic to this web server, and then the web server just sends you the traffic, but there's no way of the client saying, oh, I didn't get that traffic, can you send it again? So with UDP is what this denial of service thing is. You can fake where the IP address is coming from, or where you send the traffic. So there's all these old routers on the internet which are still running a protocol called RIP, which RIP version 1, which is basically a routing protocol in the old days where the way of telling, instead of having static routes, you'd have dynamic routes, and a RIP protocol is the way of sending those routes between routers so that routers know where things are, or if the topology changes, you would get a RIP update and it will then send it out. It would then send you the updated route and it sends it back to it so the whole technology can change. But RIP was kind of like, was depreciated because there's a couple of issues where you could only it was classless, so it meant it would only work on one sort of subnet. So it'd only work on 255.255.255.0 networks, and you couldn't have, if your net was 255.255.0.0, it would be incompatible. We're talking these like 1990 protocols here, so it might be before. But anyway, someone found a flaw in these routers. That some of these packets still request answer to the RIP. So the idea of DDoS is that DDoS sends a little request to this device and then a big packet comes out the other side. So what they do is these hackers basically fudge the packets and say, look, I want you to send all your, can I have your routing table please via RIP, and you say I'm coming from this IP address, but obviously they're not, they basically fake it, so all those packets get sent to the person who you're trying to DDoS. And basically they got an email one day to this website saying pay us some bitcoins, or if not we're going to take your website down, we're going to try you first, we're going to do you for an hour, and then if you don't after an hour, we're going to basically just to show you that we mean business, and then after the next day, if you don't pay us within 24 hours of this, pay us bitcoins, we're going to basically give you a full on attack. Well, they basically did this hour attack, and they pay for the their ISP, they actually pay for DDoS protection, but because this DDoS was so big, their internet, they've basically got like 100 meg pipe into the internet, well they pay for 100 meg, they basically flooded that, and it basically flooded the whole ISP, so it took the whole ISP out. So this ISP had got a 10 gig connection to the internet, but that got basically flooded it, and at peak they saw a 20 gig DDoS attack. So it took this whole ISP out. So yeah, so I've actually seen this DDoS thing in real life. And basically what they did to mitigate it is they basically rerouted all their website to another DDoS company, which basically knows how to handle it, who's got unlimited bandwidth basically to stop this kind of thing. But it's quite scary though, yeah. They didn't pay the money, and then they left this protection on for like 40 hours, and then they saw it drop again, so they basically took it, rerouted traffic back to the original site. But yeah, it's quite scary, this DDoS stuff. So I've accessing it in the wild. So
were they using one of those old routers with version 1?
No, they weren't. But they basically just the way it works is the hackers find out thousands of people on the internet who are running these old routers. And obviously
could they be anyone, like home users or anyone?
Yeah, these old home routers, what people have got them at home, they basically reroute the traffic. They basically just send all these requests to all these they send all these requests saying, can you send me these RIP things to these 1,000 things? And obviously that's how it multiplies the data up, if you see what I mean. Does that make sense?
Oh God. So what should we, if we come across somebody with an old router like this,
get a new one really. So you think there's millions and millions of people out there all running old routers, or everyone buying those cheap old Linksys routers or whatever, which is running all these old stuff, then yeah.
So you're watching that in real time. That must have been
mad, were seeing it. Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting, that, seeing things like that, because you tend to think half of this stuff is kind of like, I don't know, fantasy land, or it only happens to somebody else. But but actually seeing it happening. Now, I mean, I've heard of all those different ransomwares where they're after, you know, pay some money or block your computer forever, you know, and they're just viruses or whatever. But that one, they meant business, didn't they, really?
Yeah, they wanted to sell you bitcoins in 24 hours or whatever.
Right. So they could actually follow up on their threat. What did they do? They give a demonstration of it by doing it for a while, and then
they basically say, this is what we can do. Yeah. Yeah.
God. Oh Jesus. So you've had a fun time watching that. That's a good one there.
Yeah. So what have you been up to, Andy?
One thing that we're doing this week is the one thing that you were helping out with. Basically, I was over at one of my customers. In fact, we've mentioned them before, the one I've set up the network for. Mm-hmm. They've recently started up a hosted exchange to replace their old email. And this, the guy actually doing it, he actually runs the company, he's pretty au fait with most of the stuff, really. He's not bad at setting stuff up, you know, he can do all the normal stuff. And he had a few problems. He couldn't get Outlook. The company providing it said they had to use Outlook 2010, Don't know why, but they couldn't use Outlook 13. So they had to use Outlook 2010, and they provide them with a download link in order to get it. And most of them, they installed on fine, and there was this one machine where it wouldn't install. So I still actually didn't get to the bottom of why it wouldn't install on this one machine. But I basically ran a load of all the Windows repair tools that you can get in that D7 runs, or the system file checker and the registry repairer and stuff like that. I'd even run the Windows all-in-one repair tool from tweaking.com, ran that one as well. And one of those things along the line actually worked and Outlook installed. And then they set up the hosted exchange and everything was fine. And they came to this last machine, which is a laptop, and they could install Outlook on it, no problem. But they couldn't get the hosted exchange to connect to the hosted exchange server. On this particular day, I'd been to my supplier and I'd just called in to see how they were getting on and if they'd got it sorted. Only to find this problem, and I said to them, I'll remote on later on. I've got to go now. We'll remote on later and have a go. Actually, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, right, off the top of my head, I haven't got a clue what's going wrong here. So I'll message Alistair later. And while we're while they're at home or whatever, then we can remote on one night. So that's what I did, wasn't it? We remoted on one evening.
Well, the first time they turned the computer off, didn't they?
Oh, that's right. I rang him up. I said, "Is it all right to connect to the to that laptop to do that job?" And he said, "I've left it in work." He'd left it there and hadn't left it switched on. So it was no problem leaving it there; it just wasn't switched on. So the following night he left it on so we could get remote access, and then. Well, I'll leave the rest of the explanation up to you. Because in actual fact, with all the stuff that I've been doing, I've had very, very little experience, I suppose, with hosted exchange. I've set up a few, but it's really a case of, you know, putting in the correct addresses and username and passwords, and it's always ever worked first time. And this is really the first time I've had any problem with it connecting or anything like that.
Yeah,
It was trying to connect to the wrong domain, wasn't it? And that was the issue.
Yeah, so what the thing which we had, which is the problem, so they're basically running it host, they had a supplier running host exchange. I think basically what it was that they're franchise, aren't they? The people, this company, and the franchisees of the company provide them with like the domain name for that company. And that's provided by a third party. So not even Office 365, it was just some random person running Office 2010 in the cloud, Exchange 2010 in the cloud. And if your workspace, you're all on the same network as the Exchange server, you can use MAPI, which is the protocol which you can connect, which used to connect Outlook to Exchange. So you can so it's a bit more functional than the old POP3 or IMAP. But weird, that doesn't really work very well over the internet. So in 2003, they introduced a thing called Outlook Anywhere, which basically runs MAPI over HTTPS. So
is that OWA?
No, that OWA is the
that's a web access.
That's the web access.
Oh, right, yeah.
So this Outlook Anywhere means that you could sit. Before this, you'd have to connect to get Outlook to work. If you're away from the office, you'd have to connect to a VPN first, and then connect in to the VPN into the office, and then your Outlook would then connect to Exchange. Which is Outlook Anywhere after Exchange 2003, is that using HTTPS, you could enable that on the Exchange server. And you know how like you can publish OWA through your firewall.
Yep.
It's just another. It's like the web address /OWA. I can't remember what the direct URLs, but it basically puts another URL on it, and you can configure your Outlook client to basically use to connect to that URL, and then you can then, it will then your Outlook will basically work on the internet without having to connect to a VPN. So you're okay.
So it's like using it's secure, isn't it? So it's like using port 80, but it's on the secure port.
Yeah, so 443.
So you
need a certificate, normally a valid a proper SSL certificate. And that basically means that you can then connect through your Exchange absolutely fine, and then it would work. So your VPN, you haven't got a VPN, you can just literally open up Outlook wherever you are in the world, and if you've got an internet connection, which that is 443, your Outlook AC connects back to your Exchange server and then works. And the way you configure that is that normally when you first configure Outlook in the office, if you're on your local Exchange, Outlook auto configures that for you, but because you're on a domain. But because these workstations are not on the domain and nothing to do with this office, this hosted Exchange, you have to manually set up that connection. So when you go into your profile and you type in your email address, using a thing called Auto Discover, it should be able to pick up what your Exchange details are and do auto configure the rest of it for you, which is what Office 365 does for you, or if you set up your Auto Discovery. Auto Discovery is a very cool thing. Is like if you're in your domain and you're on a local machine, and that's on the domain, it uses that directory to basically find out what the Auto Discover address is, and that's just basically like a URL, and that basically tells you how your Outlook should configure, and it basically configures it all for you. So it basically tells you that, can you remember in the old days in Exchange 2000 or in Office 2003, where you had to go in and you basically had to say what your Exchange server was? So you put in your Exchange server name, and then you'd put in what your username was, and you'd say check name, whatever check it is, and it basically go off. And that's works fine. That's what the new Office products do. That when you put your email address in, it basically looks at what your email address is, and it goes off and finds the. I'd like to do a show on how Auto Discover works, because a lot of people set it up incorrectly, and that people always moan about it doesn't work properly. But if you set it up correctly in the first place, it works fine. And the problem you've got is if you're outside the domain, and you put, and you obviously they haven't got the Auto Discover set up. When you put your email address in, it wouldn't find the Exchange server, would it? It wouldn't find the online Exchange server.
That's right. Yeah, because it's not, there's no domain, and it couldn't find it. Yeah,
because these machines went on the domain. So what you have to do is it's like the advanced properties you have to go to, and you have to go to Outlook anywhere. I can't remember what the tabs are, and you can go in there, and then you basically tell it what your OW Outlook address is.
That's the HTTPS one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so he had filled in all this correctly. I'm just gonna see what that option is where you go to change it, because it's quite. I know it's always very good where you can remember things in your brain where it's just like auto where you can often do something, isn't it?
Yeah.
That was Outlook 2010, wasn't it? That
Outlook 2010, yeah. So we had that bit set up right, didn't we? Because that was we had the address, we had all the information we needed.
That's right. So you go to more settings, click connection tab, then under Outlook anywhere, it says connect to Microsoft Exchange using HTTP. Two boxes you need to tick. On fast network use HTTP first, and on slow networks use HTTP first. So those two boxes need to be ticked, because if those boxes aren't ticked, so on the fast network it means that if you're on the local LAN, if that's not ticked, it will never connect. So you have to have those two boxes ticked. So if you'd normally, if it was the old days, you'd have on the old fast network, you wouldn't use, you wouldn't want everyone using HTTP, you wouldn't use everyone using Outlook anywhere internally, you only want to use it externally. So the on the fast network should be unticked, and on the slow network, I mean when you're out of the office, that needs to be ticked. But with Hosted Exchange, you want both of those boxes ticked, okay? And I think on the far, I think they weren't ticked. So the first thing we do is we then tick those boxes. And with actually in Exchange 2013 now, there isn't any MAPI. All the MAPI is now done over HTTPS. So it uses Outlook 20. So it uses Outlook anywhere in Exchange 2013. So those two boxes have to be ticked. And then the other option was about the proxy authentication setting. It was set to NTML authentication. Yes. But because the domain, because these laptops was not on the domain, you have to select basic, because NTML means that if it was on the domain, it would use its CAS credentials to basically send that data over the internet and to basically authenticate on the server. So when you open Outlook, it won't ask you for a password because it basically uses the password of your user account built into Windows. But because we were using because these are not on domain, we have to use a basic authenticator, which basically means that the username and password gets sent in plain text. But because we're using it SSL, obviously it's the data's across the internet is basically not sent clear text. Yeah. And that's why you're using HTML. HTTPS, where they don't want to be using HTTP or port 80 anymore.
So it's a plain text password, but it's within HTTPS. So it's still secure,
So that's why we want to make sure that you're using, if this machine was on the domain, we would basically use NTML authentication. Because every time you go into Outlook, it always asks you for a password. That's because that machine is not on the domain, and that's why it always asks you for a password. Because every time you go into Exchange, it's trying to authenticate Exchange, and that's what's asking you for username and password. And then the other option issue we had is that they couldn't use their username. He was using the email address of the user account to authenticate, but because they obviously must be using Exchange 2010 and not set up correctly. It was something like, what was the username? I basically told you that you basically want to put what the NTML, what the Windows account was. So I can't remember what it was. Was it like domain or something? Or what was it? It was something silly, wasn't it? They used the domain for that.
Yeah, it matched the computer name. John something or other, wasn't it? I can't remember what it was. But somebody had named the computer name and properties of the computer was it was something dash something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so when it was asking us for the username and password for that, and it said the domain was the local machine.
Yeah. So you had the domain name of that server. You had the domain name, didn't you, for the host exchange, didn't you?
Yeah, it was something networks.local, wasn't it?
It was networks.local. Yeah, so we basically put in network / and the users in the user ID.
Yeah.
Because every time you basically put the user ID in, the password in, the username and password in, it wouldn't work. It was basically just flash back straight up, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So we basically put the domain name / which was what was it again, sorry? It was network or something, wasn't it?
Networks.local, yeah.
Yeah, so we basically put network / the username and then put the password in, boom, it
went straight away then, didn't it?
Went straight in.
So effectively it was asking for the username and password on the machine it was on.
Yeah.
And we needed to say, no, it's not on this laptop. It's over there somewhere. It's on the internet. Go and look somewhere else for it.
Yeah, because it's basically trying to use its local username and password, but obviously we wanted to tell it to use a domain password to get into it.
That's exactly what I was thinking when I looked at it the first time around. So, but after that, it just connected straight away, and it's been working ever since. So, so they're doing all right with that.
All right. Cool. So I would have gone on a bit more on about Office 365 or Host Exchange.
I've got one question about that particular thing, right? Before we go on, but this could go on to 365. This could lead into it quite nicely, right? They were told by the hosted exchange company they had to use Office 2010. Now they already had Office 13 on all of the machines, not 365, but Office 13. Why could they only use Office 2010 for their email?
It was probably because the people hadn't set up, the supplier hadn't properly set up the Exchange. Because Exchange 2013 worked with Exchange 2010.
Is this to do with that mappy thing that's been, you were talking about before?
Yeah. There might be. The only reason it might be is, I reckon they might be using Exchange 2003. Because it's,
all right.
Because Exchange 2003 doesn't support Office 2013.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I knew that. So that's a good point. So this company here has got a very old server.
Maybe. Basically.
Yeah.
Have you got the URL for the OWA there? What they've got? Don't tell them there. But have you got the URL?
I do.
That?
Yeah, I've still got it on a piece of paper right in front of me.
That's probably the why. There's no technical reason why Exchange 2010 shouldn't work. Because obviously, as I was saying earlier, Outlook Anywhere works with 2003.
Yeah, I'm just looking for it now.
You've got massive piles of paper like I do on my desk. Because I don't tell the tree huggers out there, but I hate reading things on the screen. So if I have to read a manual or something, or if I have to reread something out after I've written something, I have to print it out and...
Yeah, and I hadn't thought about that, but I did say to him at the time, I said you've got Outlook 13 on here. Why do you need Office 2010? He said, I don't know. He said that's what they told us, we had to use it, and it won't work on Office. I said, okay, fair enough. I said I thought it was a bit odd to put, they've got Office 13 on all of the computers, and yet Outlook had to be Office 10.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right, fair enough. Whatever works.
Right, so have a look. So I want to basically talk about Office 365, really, and go into a bit of a deep dive with it kind of thing. So I've been doing quite a lot of research the last couple of weeks on it. So
okay, go for it.
Go for it.
3, 2, 1, go.
So what is Office 365? So most people know it's a hosted exchange, basically. So it basically means that people haven't got to buy that. So if you're running an old Office Exchange 2003 on the site, why would you want to basically purchase a new server with the licensing for Exchange 2013? You can't go from Office 2000 or Exchange 2003 to straight to Exchange 2013. You've got to hop bar 10 to 13. So basically, Microsoft, everyone knows that. They do it best. I think they do it the best. I mean, it's their product. They run it in their house. They know what they're doing on it. So it's basically just a massive multi-tenanted exchange server, which is interesting because they run a thing. Because the exchange heavily relies on AD, so they provide a thing called Azure AD, which is basically the same as AD, but it's their multi-tenanted thing. So every person you set up for Office 365 is basically given a tenant name, and that then is separate. So each, I think it's just like, maybe, I don't know how it works, but I guess it's like a separate OU for each customer, and that basically means that in Azure AD, every customer to every tenant has his own little thing in Azure, which keeps everything separate. Because you might have two John Smiths, or there's more than two, and you have one John Smith from one Azure tenant and another in the other one, and they can have exactly the same spelling, and they could have the same username, and it wouldn't really matter because they're two separate Azure ADs. So that's really interesting about the thing. So also looks like this Office 365 is basically running a custom of Exchange 2016. There's been little hints that it's running Exchange 2016 when they would currently release features, and there's like a couple of weeks ago where they actually accidentally left a feature on. I didn't actually edit the code, and it said like something when like a meeting request from it said like sent from Exchange 2016. So even Exchange 2006 isn't even out yet. I reckon that, listen to, I think I posted on G Plus the other week about how they run Exchange Office 365. And there's kind of describing it, they kind of use it as a test bed. So that's why they're going to release Exchange 2016. It's already been tested out, it's already been working in Office 365. The interesting thing is that it's something you've got to be aware of with Office 365, is that you haven't got control of feature releases. So they could change something which you don't like, and it can automatically get rolled out to your customers. Something like this, which you might happen, is the way that things happen. Like if you have a shared mailbox in Office 365 or in normal Exchange, in Exchange 2010, if you've got this scenario set up, so let's say you've got a shared mailbox and you've got two people look after that shared mailbox. And you know you can do send as behalf of that thing. So you could have like sales mailbox, and you can say, I want to send the mail on behalf of that email, so it looks like it comes from the sales mailbox. In Office, in Exchange 2010, if you send that email, that sent item will go into the sent items of that shared mailbox. Does that make sense?
Okay.
When you then, in Exchange 2013, that functionality changed. When it gets sent, it gets put, and the message gets sent, it gets put into the user's sent mailbox who sent it. So it's a bit annoying that if you've got like a need to go and research who sent this email, you can't go to the sent items of that shared mailbox to see where that mail has gone, if you see what I mean.
Oh, I see what
you mean.
Yeah.
And we actually got stuck by the customer that. They've actually now changed that in Office 365 by releasing this new feature where you can decide where that mailbox is as an option. You can select, do you want it to go into your Exchange mailbox or do you want to go into the shared mailbox? So with Office 365, you've got to be really careful about new features coming up. And the way they do that is they roll it out to a thing called the beta users first. So there's like a really big beta plan where you can go to and you have to sign up. Then there's a thing called first release where they roll out the features to one tenant, and then the beta tenants, and then the first release, and then it goes out to everyone else. So if you want to get the features as soon as they come out, you can sign up for this first release tenant. There's also a good thing to, I'll put in the link in the show notes where it shows you the roadmap for Office 365 and the things where they're going to be changing. So when you basically sign up for Office 365, I can't remember off the top of my head if it happened or not. You basically get to sign where your region of where your data is going to be sit, because it basically shows you where the data is going to be sitting. So if you're in America, your data is going to be installed in America. If you set up you're going to be in a region of America, sorry, in Europe, sorry, it will then be stored in certain regions. So if you're in Europe, I think the options are it will be kept in Europe, but it might be in one of four data centers. I know two of those data centers are going to be Dublin and one in Amsterdam. Okay, so if you're really worried about where your data is going to be sit, if you're in the UK like us, the data is not actually sitting on UK soil. It's either sitting in Dublin or Amsterdam, and there's two more places in Europe it's also stored. I've actually closed a tab where it is, but I can't tell you any more than that. I'll put the links in the show notes. So people come on a bit worried, like I was with a customer the other day, and they said, no, our data's got to be on UK shore, or it's got to be in England. It can't be in Dublin or in America. So that's one thing to worry about. And once you signed up to a region, you can't change what region you are, what region you're assigned to. So that means that that's a very insistent decision to make when you assign it. I can't remember if it's the billing address which assigns to what region you want to, or there's an option to select what region when you first select Office 365. Also, they guarantee that they've got an SLA of 99.9%, which means that they can have a downtime of 43 minutes per month or an 8.76 hours annually. Any time the system down after that, they will apparently they will give you some money back. But that means that, that doesn't mean you get, if there's an issue with the internet, because obviously it relying on the internet, their only SLA means if your data's not available from their platform. So if they have a data center issue, then they will guarantee, they will say, look, we've got a problem, now is setting the SLA, we're now putting the time on our SLA. So they, we could be down for 43 minutes per month.
That's quite a lot, isn't it, really? I mean, you think 99.9%, and you think, well, that's practically all the time, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's only three nines. So when you start getting five nines, I can't remember what they call it. Five nines is like the, is the highest. Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. How many a year did you say that was?
They,
8 hours a year?
Yeah, 8 hours annually.
Yeah, yeah.
So, interestingly as well, they don't have any backups. They don't rely on backups. So they don't have any tape backups. They rely on the native data protection and features in Exchange. So what they have a thing called, we've talked before, is called DAG groups, which is database ability groups, which users can call database copies, is that they have your data stored over multiple servers and multiple data centers. And that's why they don't, they say, well, your data could be over four data centers. So if you have a data center failure or a single node failure, your data's database, your data's still there. And with Exchange 2013, I think it might actually 2016, it's got a self-healing thing inside it. So if it noted an issue with your Exchange database, it will repair itself. They also do a thing called a lag copy, which basically means that, let's say you have a database corruption, you can lag a copy of like a day or an hour, so they can roll your data back to an hour ago before the corruption happened. Okay. They also rely on a thing called just a bunch of disk or JBOD, which basically means that they don't have RAID in these servers.
Okay.
Where your data sits, it basically sits on a one spindle disk. So basically it just says, look, this is your Windows server. I've got 8 disks with 8 terabyte disks, so I'm going to give you 8 terabytes. That's no RAID, nothing. Just a bunch of disks. Basically just spans all your data. These are all physical servers because they believe that Exchange 2013 should run, if you're running things like this, multi-tenant system, that you should not have it running in, with all these users, you'd have it running on a single server. Because they reckon putting that virtualization layer in it causes more issues than it's worth. So basically, if they lose a disk, they use the whole data on that server. But because they're using these DAG things, like let's say they've got 4 copies of it, they're basically raiding their data across 4 servers, not across the physical disk with the RAID, if you see what I mean.
Okay.
So that's why it's cheap. They haven't got to buy a RAID card. They're just literally having a bunch of disks. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really, and then for the actual data protection of people deleting files, you've got obviously the deleted item retention period of 30 days by default. And then you can say, if the user deletes a file, they've go to the, you know, recover deleted items, then they are there. And if it's more than 30 days on, it's basically saying, basically it's tough luck. That's what you're paying for, basically. yeah, that's interesting facts. Apparently, you can actually get more functional. So basically, if you're a big corporate or something, or a government or a healthcare, you can actually go to Microsoft and say, look, I want a dedicated plan. So you give private connectivity between data centers, so you know where your data is sitting, greater service assistance, and the location of custom data is agreed with one Microsoft and the customer, and there's more customization is tolerated. And Yeah, so you get a lot more, but obviously you've got to pay the big bucks for that. So you know where your data is. It's also interesting, is like you can't pick up the phone and phone Microsoft up and say, I've got a problem. Everything is done by online chat and everything, so. And they basically, I'll put the link in the show notes, basically on TechEd, this guy showing how you'll run Office 365. It's all automated. The whole thing, the system monitor, if it sees an issue with the server, it logs it, and the people know that disks have failed, auto repairs it. So it's all really automated system. So so when you first sign up for Office 365, you basically have to choose a tenant name, and this is only something called something.onmicrosoft.com, because we could have abnab and .onmicrosoft.com. Mm-hmm. Okay, and this is what basically gives you your unique username for your account. So when you first sign up, so you'd have your username, so you could have like Alistair at abnabin.onmicrosoft.com, and that would be your username to log on to the system. So when you go to, so with the when you want to log into the OWA, let's say Office 365, there's a one or URL where everyone goes to, and in that email address where it says username is, that's where you put your, if you've got no domain set up assigned to it, you can sign in with Alistair at abnabin.onmicrosoft.com. You log in there and you can access your email, and that's actually a valid email address. So if you're someone emailed Alistair at abnabin.onmicrosoft.com, that would bounce into your Outlook. Do you see what I mean? So,
okay.
And then again, if you sent an email from that, because you haven't set any domains up, it would look like it had come from that address. Interestingly, there's also a thing called Exchange Online Directory Service, called EXOS, which is basically where all the Exchange configuration is conveyed, and then that's what basically speaks to Azure. So when you go, there's a thing called the Exchange Control Panel, which is the ECP, which is basically where you go in and you can do all your Exchange configuration. Is that's where it puts all the data into that Exchange on directory servers and then puts it into Azure. So this ECP thing is like an Exchange 2013, where you'd go now to configure Exchange, because there's no Exchange management tools, a physical tool like you did Exchange 2010. And that little, there's two controls. I think there's an admin center where you can go in there and assign a user account, and then when you basically purchase your cows, and then you can assign them to account. But if you want to do anything more, like adding email addresses, you go to the ECP. So with Office 365, you can go in there, set the accounts up manually. So let's say you're doing a basic migration to Office 365. You can go in there, and this thing called identity models is basically the default cloud identity model, is that you have your own username and password, which is basically stored in the cloud in Azure AD. So you could set up your AD. So when you add in your domain to AD, into Office 365, you can configure it. So they're having that on Microsoft address, you can change it so it's your email address. So once you've added your name, when you have to add in your domain into Office 365, you basically add it in, then you have to add a text record into Office 365. Office 365, right, says, can you add this text record to your DNS record? And it will tell you what it is. And that basically proves that you own that domain, if you see what I mean. So basically, you put that text record in, then you can go back to Office 365 and says, validate Office 365 again, query that DNS record, say, can I have the text record for your new domain name? I'm trying to add it into Office 365. And it says, yep, I can see that that's the code you said. Once you've done that, you can then start adding that email address into Office 365, and you can then change what the username is from the default one to whatever one you want to your email address. So that makes it easier for the user, because the user knows, right, I know my office, what my email address is and what my password is. The annoying thing is that means that your password is not the same as what your Windows password is. So if they're on a domain, it can get confusing because they've got a different password than what the password is on Office 365, if you see what I mean. And if you've got different password policy, if you only got 30 days on Office 365 but 90 days on your Windows domain, it can get a bit confusing if they've got different passwords. Which is not, it's just teaching you how to use it. You can then step up that with doing a directory sync, which basically syncs your AD up with the Azure AD. And what you can do there is you can sync all your email addresses and what the username is. So you can sync between the two, if you see what I mean. So it knows what it is. And it also means that you can actually do a thing where it actually syncs the passwords between the two sites. It doesn't actually put your password up in the CloudClear text. It basically puts a hash of the password in the cloud. So when you go to log on into Office 365, it's not actually authenticating you on the local domain. It's actually authenticating you on the Office 365. So let's say you've only got one server at the customer site. If you lose that site, people can still log into Office 365 because it's basically cached the hash password. So if you remember what hash password is, it means that there's no way of basically getting that password back. What it does is that when you basically encrypt the part, I don't think that's the right word, but when you log in, when you type your password into Office 365, it does some sort of calculation and it calculates it and puts it hashes it, and then it matches those two hashes. And if those two hashes match, then it lets you in. Does that make sense, Andy?
Okay. That's like I can't remember the word for what I mean. But anyway, carry on, yeah.
Yeah, so it basically means that it hashes a password. So you don't actually, so if someone steals that password, that password is, they actually physically haven't got the physical password. That all they've got is the hash.
Okay.
Of that. If Jerry was here, he'd be able to explain it better.
Is there no way of getting that password from that hash at all?
No. Right. That's the whole point of the way of, you can't reverse engineer it. You have to. So that's like, I think it's a way of like, if you encrypt your password, it means you've got your password and you encrypt it with a key. Yeah. If you've got that key, you can decrypt the password, uncrypt the password, and then you've got the password with a hash. You basically just, you've hashed the password and you can't unhash it. But if you know what the algorithm is and you basically put your password in and you run the algorithm again, you're going to get the same hash out, so you can match the hashes up and you know that you've got the same password. The other way of doing it is which is more for your bigger clients, is a thing called a directory synchronization with Federation Identity, which is basically a single sign-on, which is basically ADFSS, which is a massive product which you need at least four servers for if you want to do it properly, which basically means it's a single sign-on. So when the people log into Office 365, they go, right, I know that username and password, I need to go back to on-premise AD to authenticate you. But let's say you lose that on-site premise, it means people in Office 365 can't log on to their server. So it's really for the bigger customers when you've got thousands and thousands of people, but you need like four servers, and they recommend you have like two sites running this. So there's ways of doing is getting it the things into AD. I'll go into that more into the end of it, but the one I want to talk about first is how you can get your user data into Office 365. So we've got the classic PST way, which I've done before, is where you basically create everyone's user account in the cloud, in Office 365, show the users how they can access, make sure the users can access their email by OWA. Basically then go around, export everyone's PST, and then go on to everyone's new piece. When everyone's exported or the PST has been exported, or the way you probably do it is, I don't know before, is you basically have a switchover period So you basically switch DNS so that the mail for the MX records gets pointed to Office 365. So any new mail is now going to Office 365. Make sure everyone's accessing ABDOA, they can get their emails, and then they want to access any old emails, they can go into Outlook. And then over the weekend, what we've done, I've done before, is basically export their emails into PST, and then go into Outlook, recreate a new profile, which then obviously then authenticates with AD, sorry, auto-configured. So with Exchange 2000, with Office 365, you can set this auto-discovery record up, which you have to configure. And basically what that does is, let's say our domain name is abnabandpodcast.co.uk, is you set up a record, an SRB record, which says what auto-discovery is. And you point that at Microsoft. And what that does is when Outlook 2013 goes, what's your email address? And you put in abnabandpodcast, like alistair@abnabandpodcast.co.uk, and the password in, it then it goes and says, right, what's my email address? And it says, right, I'm now going to look at what the auto-discovery is at, so then it knows how to query this server record. And the server record says, yes, you're hosted with Office 365, go here. And Office 365 says, here's all the user details, server settings, and that's how Office 365 then reconfigures it. Then obviously then any email that's come in while it's been doing it, it's obviously downloaded it into Outlook. Then you obviously can get the PST file which you exported from the old account and then re-import it. And obviously that's then everyone's then using Office 365. So that makes sense, Andy, yeah. That the way of doing it that way?
Yeah, that's it. So I mean, the PSTs are is that the only way of doing that? Was they're getting the old emails off the old one?
Yeah. So the only that's one method. So you can do the PST mic export and then re-import onto the new profile. There's other ways of doing it.
Could you do it like with the OSTs or anything?
No, you can't do anything with the OSTs. I'm afraid.
No.
Unless you buy, I think there's a tool you can buy, but I never had it actually successfully used it. So
yeah, I've seen a few of them, but never actually tried one or bought one or anything. But okay, yeah, well that seems fair enough. Yeah,
So that's fine if you've got like 10 users or whatever, if you wanted to go there. But if you've got like start getting 50 or 100 users, then you're going to get a lot more work to do.
Yeah.
So there's three other ways of doing it. Well, there's four other. Well, there's five ways. You got the PST file,
yep.
And you've got a feature in called cutover migration, stage migration, hybrid configuration, or you've got the third party migration tool, which you've heard of that talk before,
yep.
Where you use a tool which like a web based tool, which basically you point it to your Office 365 accounts, and you point it to your old Exchange server. So it basically looks using OWA, or you have a bit of software you install on your Exchange server and you point that to Office 365, and it basically saps all the data from the old Exchange server and puts it into Office 365. But I'll go into more detail of that later. So I'm going to go through the options you can have. This might expand over a couple of weeks. So I'm just going to go through the cutover migration. So this is supported. So the Exchange servers. This basically means if you've got Exchange server on site already. So the good way of doing a PST file one is if you've got an old Exchange 2010, or they're using POP3 or IMAP, or if they're using something like Thunderbird or something, or Outlook Express. So the cutover migration is you have to be running Exchange 2003, 2007, 2010, or 2013, and it only supports if you've got less than 2,000 mailboxes. And the way the cutover migration is, it works all in one go. You set up Outlook anywhere on your Exchange server, and you basically tell Exchange Office 365 to point to your Exchange server. You don't create any accounts in Office 365. And when you're doing the migration, this cutover migration, it basically goes off and recreates all your accounts on the exchange in Office 365, and it pulls all the data in for you. And then once all the data's across, you can then at some point design a DNS flip over and point everyone, so all the mail, then the new mail gets pointed to Office 365, and then everyone can point to Office 365. So there's no, so it's quite a good way of doing it. I haven't actually done any this way. The only way I've done migration is by doing the PST migration and using a third tool. But I wanted to get my head around what the inbuilt tools were of Office 365. So what you do to configure this, you set up a new tenant and you decide your new domain name, whatever it's going to be. You and then add the domain in and the text record to say that you prove that you own it. And then you don't change any DNS records yourself. Then in Exchange 2003 or on your Exchange server, you set up Outlook Anywhere and make sure you've got an SSL cert, because it doesn't really work if you've got a self-signed certificate. Then test that the this all works with the Remote Connectivity Analyzer, which is a brilliant tool if you ever haven't used it. It's basically a tool used by Microsoft, and you can basically put in your email address and it will go and see if your auto-discovering working, if your OWA is working correctly. It's a very good tool. You also need to make sure that you configure auto discovery correctly so it knows how to connect to your Exchange server. Once you've got all that working, make sure you've got any stale delegations. So that means, like, if someone's left and they've got delegation rights, you need to remove that. Also make sure that there's no managers assigned to mailboxes. Apparently with this way of cut over migrations, that you don't have it can't copy mailing enabled security groups. It can only copy distribution groups in Exide Exchange. So if you've got like a security group with an email address on it, you need to basically you need to create the blank security group in Office 365 with the on Microsoft.com address to match the Exchange, but don't put the proper email address in. Because what happens is that once you do the import, it will auto fill in all the other information for you. Also, remember to review this large item thing I'll talk about, where it won't import anything over bigger than 25 meg. They're at the up limit now, but that feature only works on if you're doing a PST migration or if you're doing the thing about the hybrid configuration, okay? So once you've done all that, you can then go into... you basically go into Office 365 under EAC, which is that thing I was telling you earlier about. You can then go into recipient migrations and then you can select migration exchange and select cutover migration. In there you basically put in the email address of, basically I forgot to say, you need to create a user account which has got full permissions over all the mailboxes in so that's how it pulls all the data in. Put that username and password into that username, but that user will have an email address. Put the email address in the password, and it will basically, using Auto Discover and Outlook Anywhere, it will go and discover all the mailboxes. There's no way of telling it to not import a mailbox. So do a bit of tidying up first, delete all the old mailboxes, delete all the emails accounts you don't want to basically migrate into Office 365, because it will import everything. So if you've got mailboxes like people have now left, you want to basically delete them, export them to PST or whatever your retention period, what you do when someone leaves the company. You can basically then, the people in Outlook can basically still use their existing email addresses. Once the migration is happy, it will basically email that the admin a list of all the email accounts they've got, and it will then send you that it's all happened successfully, that any problems, what you need to go and do. It also gives you the usernames of the people and the passwords of the of what the user accounts are for the new email boxes. And also, going back, you can't, now I was saying about this thing about the syncing the passwords between the Office 365. It's basically, the old product is called DirSync, but the new one they called ADD Sync is a utility which basically syncs between the passwords between the two between the on-site AD and the Azure AD is that you, that's my telling short then, it will then, you can't, with the cutover migration, you can't install that tool until after the migration has happened. Once that's done, you can then make sure that people can log into Office 365 with any username and password. Once you're happy with that, you can then do a DNS switch over. So all the new mail will now be coming over to the Office 365. You can then do another final sync, and that will then sync everyone over to Office 365, sync all the data. And so any old emails which may have basically come in to the old way will then be synced over to Office 365. The only problem is now everything's working, so you've got it cut off in Office 365. Obviously, you now need to go around to everyone's PC and reconfigure everyone's Outlook. The problem you're going to have there is that if you're using Exchange 2007, when you get to set up the profile, auto discovery will try and point everyone to the old Exchange server. So it basically keep reconfiguring it to the old Exchange server. You see what I mean? Because obviously in AD, it still thinks that the Exchange server on site for it. So what you have to do, you basically, is command you run in Exchange, which is basically auto discovery server's internal URL, and you basically run a command and you basically point that through to Office, basically point it to the Office 365 URL. So when the people go into Office Outlook, it basically automatically reconfigures the person, the Outlook client, to go to Office 365. Does that make sense, Andy?
Yeah. The one thing that's always got me about it is the time. What about the time scale in these migrations? You can do it the PST way, the other way, and things like that. I mean, potentially it can take a long time, can't it? So with doing the it this way, is it all much quicker?
Yeah, so you could basically set this off, this migration in the background happening a week ago, a month ago, before.
Right.
So it's syncing the data through. How often it will check. I think it syncs every 24 hours. Every 24 hours it will redo another resync after it's completely done the first syncing of it. So, yeah, and also if you've got clients on the network which aren't on the domain, you have to go into AD and reconfigure. If you've got basically a machine which is not on AD, and obviously it won't use auto-discover using the, it will basically use DNS. You need to go into DNS and update the service record to point to auto-discover. Yeah, so once you've done that, obviously then that's quite annoying because it means you've got to go in and go to everyone's PC and then obviously reconfigure their profiles, which is a bit time-consuming if you've got quite a lot of users. Also, by default, when all those users get in part of the provisioning process, they will get a free 30 days grace period. So when you import all those people in, those mailboxes will each be given a license. Okay, so there you got with Office 365, you basically get given you buy how many licenses you want. So say if you've got 10 people who need access to email, so what they mean today is, I think it means if they can send and receive as their primary email address. Okay, so you've got to log into you can basically assign a user account to a license to that user, you see what I mean, and then if someone leaves, you can obviously archive that mailbox, export to PST, delete that user account, unassign the license, create a new user account, and then assign the license to it. With the older Exchange 2010, 2013, 2003, you could obviously have shared mailboxes. And obviously at the moment, when you import that into Office 365, that takes up a license. But with Office 365, you can convert that mailbox into a shared mailbox, and that mailbox won't need a license. And multiple people can obviously then access that shared mailbox, but that cannot be a primary mailbox, if that makes sense, Andy.
Okay, right.
So yeah, so that makes it. So you could, so if they say they've got 10 users, but they've got 12 mailboxes, like then they've got two mailboxes, like a what they share, like a account mailbox and a sales mailbox. Those two sales and account mailbox do not need a license. So that's basically a cutover migration, which is like the first way. And then we've actually, I've basically got three different things, three ways. So I've basically I'm going to leave it there. I'm not going to go into any more. So I think that's quite a good place to leave it, I think. And next week I'll go on to staged migrations and the hybrid migration, which I haven't actually looked at yet because it's a lot of pages to read. So you've got any questions there, Andy?
Not only does it take a long time to do a migration, but it takes a while to explain it all as well.
Finally kind of got my head around it, and I wanted to do, so I'm going to go quickly. So these other tools you've got, so this ADD Sync thing basically is a piece of software you can install on it. You have to be, I think it's, you have to be 2008 higher. They recommend a 2008 DC, and the domain's got to be at Windows 2003 functional level. And they recommend you don't really have it on the DC, but you can install it on DC. It basically uses SQL Express, and basically that's what syncs all your user accounts from your AD, and it syncs into Azure AD. So, but I'll go into that next time a bit more. So as I was saying about the last episode a couple of ago, it was like we've been going on for a year. I wanted people, if they could maybe send us an email, how they'd like the show to go. Do they like the way of where we just come on and just chat, and we have a bit of a chat where we just show what we've been doing in the last week at work? Or do you like it when we like the episode tonight where we actually go into more detail or how we can improve it? So if you've got any ideas of emails in, what, let us know how you think. Do you want us to keep going on the mixture of both, or what direction you want us to go in? Does that make sense?
Kind of right, Andy? When we started off, we kind of had episodes about specific subjects, didn't we? A bit like today in a way. As time's gone on, we've kind of brought our own stories from the trenches, and especially with the three of us, sometimes those stories from the trenches have lasted an hour. You know, sort of took up the entire episode. Whereas interesting as they are, you know, that's exactly it. What does everybody want, really? You know, they're the two different things. Or if you've got any other ideas, or a mixture of both, or one or the other. Because we want to talk about what people want to hear. And if we're talking about what people don't want to hear, then we want to know about it.
Yeah, because it, like, tonight, it took me a long time. It's a lot of prep going there. And I find it really hard to kind of read and say at the time. So I've kind of like, I read it all in one bit and then I cut it down into little smaller chunks. So yeah, just let me know what you think, really. Tonight is a lot, only because I've been doing it at work. I've been basically researching for work, and I wanted to make sure, and the way I can make myself learn is by reading it again and then explaining it to someone else to kind of to do it, kind of thing. So the other one people want me to email in is that one of the difficulties I have at work is that I've never really been defined with dyslexia, or is that I find it really hard to write things down. I can write, if I have to write a proposal, I write something down. I can sometimes take a long time to write things down. So I could write something down, and then but I know what I want to say in my head, but it doesn't read how I want it on the paper. So the way I'm currently working is I kind of write it all down on my bit of paper, and then rejig it about, and that can take some time. And sometimes things like and I might read it to myself three or four times, and it'll sound completely fine to me. I'll even sometimes print it out for the big proposal, and then someone comes to me, Al, why have you said it like that? Because I like it. It's my brain is like rereading it for three or four times, and my brain knows what I want it to write. And yeah. One of the things I want to really improve on is my spelling and grammar. And like sometimes like I'm really rubbish about putting where commas are and putting capital letters. What do people think I should do to improve that? Do you think I should go back to college in night school or whatever and get my GCSE back in English? But I don't think I want to basically make my writing more, I don't know if it's creative. I want to, and I try to Google it and I can't work out how the word, maybe someone can kind of come up with a way of describing how I've, what's failing it on it, so that I can basically, because I think that's one of the things what kind of it's just troubling me at the moment, trying to, and that's what I think I failed at the moment. I'm wondering if anyone has how they can, got any tips or to kind of get past that kind of thing. So
yeah, that's I've had the same thing, you know. It's in your own head it works out perfectly fine and it makes 100% sense, but then somebody else listens to it and they think, what the hell are you going on about? And then it's just a different opinion of it, really, isn't it? It's just a different view sometimes.
Yeah.
So
it's like when I write blogs and I read people's blogs and it sounds really good, and then I write something and it sounds rubbish. So that's why one of the, what, how can you be that kind of, how can you write, how do you get that kind of, I don't know if it's creativity, or that's why I'm wondering if someone could email in to maybe help. So okay, well, really enjoyed tonight, really. Been hopefully Jerry will be back next week with us when he finally gets his new house, but he could have a super fast broadband, so hopefully we won't have so many issues with him dropping out on us or whatever. So
yeah, that was one of the things in his old place, wasn't it, with the it wasn't through any fault of his own, it was just his location, I think, you know, having a slow broadband connection. And but yeah, if he has this new place, I don't know if he's getting fibre or what, but that'd be nice.
Yeah, I think he's getting fibre, so that's good.
Yeah,
alright then. Well, as always, you can contact us at mail at abnabnpodcast@kdk, or go to the website and on there you've got all our links to our social media sites. So right, speak to you all soon, guys.
Yeah, see you next time. Bye now.
Bye.